Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking as we do most weeks at this time at the worlds of economics and politics. Three guests up today. First, in a few minutes, we'll hear an excerpt from a 2005 interview with Dan Lazar on the awfulness of the Supreme Court. After that, we'll hear from Jamie Webster, an analyst with the D.C.-based consulting firm PFC Energy, on the state of the oil market. And then we'll hear from Peter Fraze, an editor with the wonderful new radical magazine Jacobin, about sex work and work. In anticipation of the Webster interview, some thoughts on oil. Longtime listeners will know that I've never bought peak oil theory. The notion that we're anywhere near close to running out of the stuff seems preposterous. Believe it or not, domestic U.S. production is now at the highest level in 10 years. A major reason is high prices. They call forth massive feats of discovery and innovation. That's the story behind the rise in U.S. production, a reversal of a long downtrend that ran from 1985 through 2008. And that's not all. The North Sea, once thought to be totally mature, is now the site of fresh discoveries. And then there are the Canadian tar sands, which hold enormous reserves of oil. When prices are above $75 a barrel or so, they're now around 100 for U.S. domestic oil, and around 125 for the internationally quoted Brent North Sea variety, it makes economic sense to find and lift this stuff. And that's not good. The rise in U.S. production has been aided by fracking, the horribly destructive technique of fracturing rock by injecting pressurized chemicals underground and extracting the oil and gas they yield. The chemicals are deeply toxic, and the technique probably causes earthquakes. Offshore drilling inevitably gives rise to spills. Developing the Canadian tar sands would be an environmental disaster locally, and burning all of this stuff threatens life on Earth, no matter where it comes from. When it comes to oil, the only thing to worry about is burning even a quarter of what we know we have. I suspect a lot of people who invoke peak oil want to believe it's true, because it would force us to move to a post-carbon future. But telling people you're running out of something doesn't necessarily promote sensible behavior. It can provoke desperate measures, selfishness, and xenophobia. There's a line from the poet A.R. Emmons that I love, "Who wouldn't turn up the voltage when you know the lights are going out?" Given the scale of the climate crisis and the possibilities we have for doing so much if the political will were there, it's not helpful to emphasize dwindling supplies. It's far more helpful to say that we don't need any big breakthrough inventions. We need to develop the alternatives that we already know about and put ExxonMobil out of business. Back after a musical break. Microcosmos No. 92 by Bella Bartok, performed by Cornell's Impleni. First up, an excerpt from a 2005 interview I did with the journalist Dan Lazar, author, among other books, of The Frozen Republic, on the awfulness of the U.S. constitutional system. Watching the hearings on Obamacare has annoyed me no end. All that Supreme Court handicapping is bad enough, but then to watch liberals preemptively mourning the striking down of what is mostly an awful bill, recycled Republican ideas from the 1990s, including forcing people to buy crappy, expensive insurance from odious vendors. This has all been very weird. But what do you expect when this bill has almost no passionate support, no movement behind it? Okay, here's Dan Lazar from 2005, just after Bush had nominated John Roberts as Chief Justice. Well, let's turn a little bit to the Supreme Court. There's acres and acres of coverage of the Supreme Court, the Roberts nomination. Liberals, if we look at the sort of the left side of the political spectrum, liberals are obsessed with the Supreme Court. Is all this obsession justified?
Yes and no. I mean, you know, the Supreme Court is, you know, has emerged from the least important of the three branches to the most important of the three branches. I mean, all the other branches, especially Congress, have been happy to shunt off responsibility onto the backs of the courts. This has been a process that's been going on for 50 years now.
What do you mean by that?
Starting in the 1940s, I mean, Congress was happy to duck the important issues, such as race, for example, and leave it to the Supreme Court to decide. And both liberals and conservatives collaborated in this ducking of responsibility. And, of course, when the Supreme Court did decide, and, you know, in Brown v. Board of Ed in 1954, liberals were ecstatic and were convinced that their strategy had paid off because they had created this kind of new liberal court, or this new liberal court had been created since 1937. And it was a powerful new instrument for social reform. So they were happy to have, you know, Congress marginalized and the Supreme Court then take the lead.
Well, let's go back into the 30s, though. When Roosevelt was unhappy with the court, he tried to pack it with a whole bunch of new members who would be friendly to him. So what happened to the liberals who then made friends with the Supreme Court?
Well, I mean, Roosevelt lost the battle and won the war. The court packing proposal was beaten back. The court did an about-face and suddenly approved all the New Deal legislative proposals that they had previously overturned.
And well, there's an old cliche: the Supreme Court reads the election returns.
Right. But the idea is, yes, the court is supposedly above politics, but nothing is really ever above politics. So the court is certainly aware of what's happening outside its chambers. The 1937 started the court on a great trek to the liberal side of the spectrum, but that has essentially stopped since the 1970s. Roe v. Wade in 73 probably marked the high watermark, and the conservatives have mounted a great counteroffensive, and have succeeded in pushing the court farther and farther to the right, and transforming it, returning it to its traditional role as a guardian of conservative constitutional virtues in this country. And certainly, the Roberts nomination is part of that trend. Bush wants to. You know, even if Bush is ridden out of town on a rail, he wants to leave, you know, govern from the grave by leaving his imprint on the court.
Or government from his ranch,
right.
In his retirement. Well, let's go back into history. How did the court emerge out of the Constitution in its early years? How did the Supreme Court emerge into this extraordinarily powerful role as an arbiter of whether laws were proper or not?
Well, you have a document, you have a constitution, which is almost impossible to change. So consequently, everything, an interpretation becomes all important. And the court, even no matter how reluctant it's been at various points, has been essentially forced to serve as interpreter in chief. And this is a very powerful position. And we see at key points the court has stepped in and interpreted the Constitution in various ways, and which has just really altered the course of American political development. Some of the rulings on states' rights, on contract law in the early 19th century, certainly on slavery in the 1850s, which led directly to the Civil War. And then, you know, of course, in the post-Civil War period, a series of rulings that were increasingly favorable to large corporations, which facilitated the explosive growth of American corporate capitalism.
And, of course, there's always this ridiculous fetish of trying to figure out what the framers meant. But what was the intention of the Supreme Court? Was it intended as some kind of check on democracy or what?
It was originally considered to be the least important of the three. It was going to be sort of the umpire, and everyone assumed that Congress would be the most important of the three. Congress would sort of serve as a quasi parliamentary body, and Congress would set policy, which the president would then carry out, and the Supreme Court would occasionally step in to adjudicate disputes. But obviously, the courts as Congress has withered and as politics have withered. The court has played an increasingly, you know, dominant role until now. It has now gone from the least important, the least among equals, to the greatest among equals.
And what do you make of the Roberts himself?
Well, Roberts is, I mean, he's clearly bad. I mean, he seems to be bad, but of course this whole process is so enigmatic that you really can be quite sure. Everyone has the David Souter example in mind, where Souter seemed to be a conservative Republican and now has blossomed into what seems to be a somewhat liberal member of the Supreme Court. So
it's very weird. You appoint these guys, you don't really understand exactly what they're all about, and then they're around for 30 years.
Well, it's an example of how the system really, really dissolves accountability. There really is no accountability, and there really is no responsibility. People, you know, senators will go and vote for this guy, and and they'll have the perfect excuse. They really have no idea who they're voting for.
Well, there's this presumption the president deserves the person that he nominates.
That's a presumption of the president's favor.
Unless you're got some raving scandal in a skeleton in his closet.
But. Right, which is why they always play the game of trying to find the scandal. But yeah, the presumption is
but
always
in the
president's
favor. It's not a political appointment. So.
Right, supposedly its law is above politics. And to a strange way, it is above politics in this country, which is why we've seen the incredible expansion of the legal realm and the shrinkage of the political realm and shrinkage both quantitatively and qualitatively, where our political intelligence is just plummeting. You have this amazingly nihilistic ruling class and a population at large, which a large portion of which is simply just turned off and hopelessly inert.
But the Supreme Court is still one of the most respected institutions of society.
Yeah.
Which says something about our society, I guess. But well, one of my beefs with the court is that or there's this whole litigious or legalistic approach that a lot of liberals pursue these days, which is that it's all about filing lawsuits. There's no organization. There's no ideological agitation. You look at the pro-choice movement. It really has done almost no kind of political organizing. We depend on the court to protect our civil liberties.
That's quite true. I mean, liberals were in a very bad spot in the 40s and 50s. The Congress was dominated by these hidebound reactionaries and Southern Dixiecrats, really controlled all the major committees. And so that avenue seemed to be totally blocked as an avenue for reform. So the liberals, turned to the courts. But clearly in hindsight, over the long haul, they ended up making a pact with the devil, because as they turned to the courts, they became increasingly litigious, cut off from any democratic base, and politics came to be articulated in this highly arcane academic discourse of constitutional law. And meanwhile, the average person was sort of left off, was marginalized and was often very resentful over his or her marginalization. So consequently, a mass, a basis was created for a kind of a mass resistance, the famous silent majority of the Nixon years.
But then, this kind of takes us back to where we started, which is this immense detachment of the American public from politics is no accident, as the vulgar Marxists used to say. It's a whole process of structural decisions that have brought it about.
Well, I think the first of the theory behind the Constitution itself is a theory of that the people are a mob, therefore the people must be controlled by a body of unalterable law. Number one, but number two is as this system has become increasingly sclerotic over the years, that process has gone farther and farther. So the people are more and more marginalized. There are profoundly undemocratic features of the U.S. Constitution, which the people are simply powerless to change due to an abstract body of law which says that people can't affect it. The Second Amendment, the question of equal state representation in the Senate, which is just—
The Senate literally cannot be abolished under American constitutional right now.
It can't be reformed. It can't be the question of the principle of equal state representation is literally unchangeable. It would require the unanimous approval of all 50 states to change. Which would never happen. So therefore, consequently, you have a lily white Wyoming has the same number of senators, the same number of votes as a California, which is what the first minority-majority state where whites are actually a minority. This exists nowhere else in the world. There's nowhere, no other legislative body is this inequitable, this undemocratic.
But that was the design of the Senate, wasn't it?
It was, but the inequities were much less in the 1790 than they are today.
But wasn't it what's that phrase of Jefferson's? It was a saucer meant to cool the hot tea? Or?
That was actually Washington's phrase. That was the idea. The idea is that the people are a mob. They're passionate. They're unthinking. So therefore, we must surround them with all kinds of legal hedges to rein them in. This is a very undemocratic concept. But the idea is, so we have the Senate. We have this profoundly undemocratic, profoundly racist Millionaires Club, we call the U.S. Senate, which the people – no, made in the people's name, but which the people are unable to reform. They're prevented by law from reforming. Second Amendment is the same thing. The Electoral College is the same thing. It's all this increasingly sclerotic, paralyzing structure.
But of course, we take the Constitution as a sacred document.
Yeah. Whatever happens, and I assume that Roberts will be confirmed. But even if he was stopped, I mean, this process of decay is going to accelerate. I'm absolutely sure of that.
How's Dan Lazar, author of, among other things, The Frozen Republic, a book about the awfulness of the U.S. constitutional system? That was an excerpt from a longer 2005 interview. My next guest is Jamie Webster, a senior manager of PFC Energy, a Washington-based consultancy. Oil prices fell from a peak of over $140 a barrel in 2007 to a recession low of $60 in 2009. They've been creeping up ever since, despite weak demand and reasonably plentiful supplies. Why? Here's Jamie Webster with some answers. The price of oil is, although it's come down in the last few days, is still rather high, and we have a rather weak global economy. To start with, what's your overview of why prices are over $100 right now?
Right now, our view is that a lot of this price increase that has occurred in the last couple of months is actually largely politically based. There is plenty of supply right now that to handle what the market needs. It is largely the effects of going and pushing hard on Iran with sanctions and squeezing it to the point that it's going to be having real difficulty later this year with finding a home for its barrels. And then with that is, you know, still some market concerns that there could be some altercation with either the U.S. or Israel or others with Iran, you know, either later this year or early next year.
And I know this is hard to quantify, but what do you think the price would be? What neighborhood would the price be in if it weren't for this Iranian nervousness?
We generally try to stay away from talking about, you know, what the price would be without X or Y, simply because it's, you know, it's impossible to go and buy a risk-free barrel. But we would estimate that probably the price would be, you know, I don't know, $15 to $20 less than it is right now due to the sanctions and other pressures on Iran.
And then what's the effect of Libya? Is Libya selling oil?
Oh, Libya is actually one of the good news stories in the oil markets. While they, you know, took most or all of their production offline during their civil war and uprising in 2011, because both sides viewed their need to be able to capture that oil revenue once the conflict ended, neither side really made substantial efforts to try to damage the oil infrastructure, and so in the last, you know, 6 or 8 months, almost all of their oil production has come back online.
And speaking of damaged oil infrastructure, what's the state of the Iraqi industry now?
The Iraqi industry is trying to get itself stood up. There has been some oil production increases, and we expect that will continue this year. But they're really hampered at this point by a lack of proper infrastructure, essentially that the ability, the takeaway capacity to be able to move the oil out of the fields through the pipes, through pumping station one and off to the single point mooring systems.
What's holding it all back?
A lot of it is in large part a lack of strategic thought on the part of the Iraqis, and part of this, the reason why, is not because they're not intelligent or the like, is simply because as they're held up by politics. As we know here in this country, when politics are rather fraught and they are fighting over various issues, it's difficult to get anything done, especially when it's something big. So there's really not a cohesive sort of strategy for how to deal with oil. So it's not, you know, there's not a clear agreement on, okay, well, if we need to get, you know, this pumping station put in or the like, who pays for that, who does it, who plans it, you know, who gets the contract work and the like. And so that's, you know, really kind of holding some things back. And there's, you know, increasing issues with politics, both, you know, within Baghdad, but also with, you know, dealing with the KRG in the north.
How active are foreign companies in Iraq now?
There's quite a number of foreign companies that are very active in Iraq, but increasingly there's increasing concerns about the security environment there. But there's quite a number of international companies from around the world that are operating in Iraq.
And in the run up to the war and during the war, there are a lot of people who thought that George Bush has invaded Iraq to steal Iraqi oil for the American majors. But it's a pretty multinational presence there now, isn't it?
Actually, the American presence is very limited. If he did that, he got the countries wrong. I mean, essentially, this oil is largely being developed by companies that are not in the U.S. But the reality is that whether it is done by a U.S. company or whether it is done by a foreign company, this oil will as it increases will make its way out into the global oil market. So from that standpoint, it's less about the U.S. and more about that supply will end up helping global balances.
And now let's look some at the supply and demand situation, starting with demand. We have a U.S. economy that's growing, but not very strongly. We have the EU in what looks like a recession. China is slowing down. What is the demand for oil looking like now and through the next year or so?
Yeah, this year we forecast oil demand is, I think, between 1.1 and 1.2 million barrels a day, which is actually fairly a fairly strong number. This is partly from base level effects as the demand in Libya, which was essentially zero last year, kind of comes back to normal levels. China, we still have growing at around 500,000 barrels a day. Their economy is the pace of their economy, you are right, is slowing, but the economy itself is obviously still on a very strong strong trajectory, but in many ways that slowdown of the growth is one that the Chinese leadership is in favor of. The United States and most of the developed world is either at flat or even declining oil demand as they as they deal with higher prices and demographics that cause the their demand for oil to shrink or stay flat.
And as Chinese consumption rises and they have more cars and want to have more gadgetry, are they requiring more or less oil per unit of GDP than they had in the past?
You've got me stumped. I can't recall that one right off the top of my head. I'm sorry. I believe that it's they are actually still moving up. And if you look at their 5-year, the 12th 5-year plan, they do want to reduce that intensity. But that plan is really one of aspiration and kind of gives an indication of what direction they're going to be going in. Clearly, the Chinese recognize that as they continue to grow, they can't move to a United States style of oil demand on a per capita basis. The global supply just cannot accommodate that, and so they are increasingly looking at other options from natural gas, continuing to use their coal, amazing strides in trying to promote efficiency and conservation.
And now on the supply side, the Saudis have expressed some discomfort with the high level of oil prices. First of all, why would that make them uncomfortable? And second of all, what are they doing to offset it?
They're uncomfortable for the same reason a person would be uncomfortable if they're suddenly given a large amount of money at their job while recognizing that the job that the business itself was going in the tank. It's great on that day, but there's a recognition by the Saudis that we are at or near prices that the globe cannot accommodate for a long period of time, and so they are always concerned about yes, they do want to make sure that they get their full value for the oil, but the price that it is set right now is one well above what they actually need, and two, they're increasingly concerned that you're going to have the sort of downturn that you had in 2008 when you had oil prices collapse from 147 down into the 30s and 40 dollar mark, which is something that they really would rather they would rather have it at a lower, slightly lower but more sustainable price rather than this this up and down, which is, you know, which is something that neither producers nor consumers really, really like, is that price that, you know, bounces up and down. You know, everyone feels a little bit better when you've got at least some certainty.
And I'm sorry to keep pinning you down on numbers, but do you think they'd be more comfortable 70, 90? What's their comfort range?
We're doing our threshold pricing, which is, you know, essentially the amount of the dollar level that they would require in order to be able to balance their current account. And I think we've got that now at around, we're still updating it, but around $70. But then if you figure they want to have a little bit of buffer, as well as enough to make sure that they can get broad OPEC cohesiveness if they need to suddenly bring production off the market because, you know, we suddenly had demand go into the tank. Most of the OPEC members really would like a price of around $100. And when I'm talking about that, I'm talking about the Brent price, which for, you know, many Americans look at, you know, WTI, which is, you know, $15, $20 lower than Brent, as I think it's trading at around 103, 104 right now. But the Brent price is, you know, in the 120s. And so that, so there's some, you know, they would not mind it coming down, you know, $15, $20.
And this is a bit inside baseball, I suppose, for radio, but why is there that $15, $20 gap between the two measures?
The difference is really that, you know, that the U.S. Market is flooded with crude inland, in that you've got a lot of crude at the Cushing point, which is in Oklahoma, which is basically a large tank farm, and that has historically been kind of one of the homes of U.S. oil, and that was the place that the price was set for, you know, a number of decades. But over time, it has become, you know, disconnected from the rest of from the global market, just because there's not enough takeaway capacity, and that ends up depressing the price there at Cushing. And so you've had this for, you know, it has happened a couple of times in the last couple of years, but now over the last 18 months or so, it's largely become essentially a close to permanent condition.
And I think I read the other day there's some constraint on pipeline capacity getting oil from there to the East Coast. Is that true?
That's correct. Yeah, and that's particularly actually that is more on the product side. You know, this summer, now that you've had a number of refineries on the East Coast shut down because they haven't been able to make money, there's a real concern that that there's just not going to be enough product by that I mean gasoline, diesel, and the like on the East Coast to really be able to handle supply. That's not to say that there's going to be a shortfall, but what it does mean is essentially, you know, in the past, if you asked a you know, kind of on the street U.S. citizen, you know, what state has the highest gasoline price, they would invariably say California, and that's generally been true for the last, you know, couple of decades. But this summer, as it was for a short period of time last summer, it is likely that actually the East Coast is going to have higher gasoline prices than California.
I live in New York City. We're used to high prices here.
Yeah, well, it'll be a little higher.
And now we're seeing that the U.S. production levels, U.S. oil production, is at the highest in about 10 years. What's responsible for this upsurge in U.S. production?
Largely, it's and I imagine a lot of your listeners are aware of the technology of horizontal drilling and hydraulic fracturing, which has been used to great success and concern on the environmental side in natural gas. And now that is being used increasingly in the U.S. to bring out, to increase our oil production, to go back to old oil fields and hydraulically fracture those fields. And you're also increasing the amount of production that's coming out of Canada. And they are, you know, moving that increasing amounts down into the U.S.
Now, do these new technologies invalidate Hubbard's Peak, or is that still apply?
Well, Hubbard's Peak always applies when it comes to particular fields. But our view in terms of, you know, for the view on, you know, the theory behind, you know, kind of global peak oil is taking the Hubbard's Peak, which is essentially, you know, a engineering peak where, you know, once you get to half of a field developed that you can get the oil out, you know, the production will necessarily fall. And then that has been applied to, you know, on a country basis and a global basis. The problem with that is, of course, that, you know, that there are other fields that you may not be aware of. And also because of technologies such as this, you know, you can go back in and essentially get more oil out of those same fields that was previously, you couldn't get before because they weren't economically recoverable.
So what about the global supply picture? Is it seriously supply constrained over the next couple of decades?
We aren't necessarily, we don't really see that. You've still got plenty of supply coming out of OPEC. Increasingly, you're starting to see some production increases out of non-OPEC. So the U.S. certainly being one of them, but there are others as well, such as Russia is still increasing. China is actually moving up a bit. Brazil is perhaps not going to be as strong as some were hoping, but it's certainly going to be a key producer. And Canadian oil sands, we're very bullish on that.
Yeah, what about the Canadian situation? I mean, what kind of difference would that make if those are fully developed?
In terms of the differences, I don't see it being a breaker of the OPEC cartel or anything like that, where you're suddenly going to have substantially lower prices. Those projects are some of the most expensive projects in the world, and the only reason that they work is because of oil prices being, not necessarily exactly where they are now, but certainly at a plus $80-$90. Level. I mean, if you start to drop below that level, then they just don't work, and you would cease to get the production out of them.
And now we're also seeing rising U.S. gas production. To what degree will that substitute for oil?
Well, you're already seeing. One, there's the production, the switch from oil-fired power generation to gas-fired generation has been in the works for a number of years, and so you're not going to see too much more of that. The ability to switch between oil and gas is it's not an easy sort of thing. Instead, you're going to see that gas used. It's going to be about coal to natural gas switching. So you'll see less use of coal-fired facilities and more use of natural gas-fired facilities, which has a host of pluses to that. The real place where you would be able to make that switch is if you could get vehicles either electric, electric-driven vehicles, or natural gas-fueled vehicles, which is, it takes a bit of a we're still working on that technology, but also it's about building out the infrastructure so that you can, find a fueling station or a place that you can, recharge your car as needed.
And what about the economic effect of these prices? At what point do high oil prices become a serious economic drag? Are we there yet? Below this? Above this?
In terms of an economic drag, I mean, you certainly start to see the drag already in terms of demand. We're actually conducting a study right now to kind of examine that very thing. But I would say that the prices that they are right now are very close to the point where it is. We can handle it for a few months, but after a while, it will start to. I would imagine it would start to impact global economic growth. Some countries being hit more than others.
And with prices at this level, you already mentioned that it makes development of like the tar sands in Canada economic. But what about alternative forms of energy, renewable forms of energy? Do prices this high really encourage those?
No, I mean they do in terms of looking at the vehicles that I spoke of earlier. So electric fired vehicles and the like. But the problem, of course, at least in the United States, is that most of the renewable sort of technologies are really about power generation. And that is now competing against some very cheap natural gas. And so it's very difficult for some developers that are interested in building out renewable energy to try to make enough money with their projects without subsidies and the like to be able to compete against that very low price that natural gas affords. Now, the upside of that is, of course, that means that people like you and I are actually paying much less for our electricity costs. And that, so one, that's helping to offset some of the gasoline price increases, although not completely. But it also, it gives some advantages to some of our industry here in the United States.
But there's nothing like the psychological salience of that gas price, is there?
Well, you don't, your natural gas price you see, once a month or in some parts of the country once a quarter when you get your natural gas bill. whereas gasoline, as everybody knows, you see that, you know, multiple times every time you're driving. So it's a real reminder, and for many Americans, it's, you know, when they go to try to figure out how the economy is going, they look at two things. You know, one, do I have a job, and do people around me have a job? And number two, what is that gasoline price? And that in many ways drives a lot of Americans' views on, you know, how they feel the economy is doing.
And another kind of inside baseball question, but the price of futures 5 years out are, you know, what, $15, $20 below the price of spot oil. Why is it sloping downwards like that?
That's a lot of times people look at that and say, okay, well, that means that the price of oil is cheaper. But actually, you need to look at the front part of the curve. Really, what's happening is, you know, there's so much demand for the crude right now. What the market is really saying is, I value the crude today so much more, I would rather have it now than have it 5 years from now, and so I'm willing to pay more. So you have to look at, instead of looking at, you know, today's point and saying, okay, where's the price going to be in the future? It's really, you know, that front of the curve is really being pulled up because it is so demanded so much. So often when you have, you know, so if you have a downwardly sloping curve on your futures market, that is actually indicative of a very strong market. And if it's in reverse, that is actually indicative of a weak market.
The long-term one being something more like a long-term equilibrium price, and the spot price being something like just current conditions.
Exactly.
And then finally, the issue of the dollar in pricing. You had some more fevered conspiracy types saying that the reason that Iraq was invaded was that it was talking about using euros or moving away from pricing its oil in dollars. People are saying the same about Iran now. Is there anything to this? And what is the long-term picture for the oil being priced in dollars, do you think?
I anticipate that oil, in large part, will be priced against dollars for the foreseeable future. There's no... You know, a big push like that would have to come from Saudi Arabia and others, and they have not shown any indication that is something that they're really seriously interested in doing.
And how much would it matter to the U.S. if it changed?
I think it would be a bit of a big deal, but I think, you know, you don't hear a lot about it simply because it is so. It just doesn't seem to be in the cards right now.
I was Jamie Webster, a senior manager with PFC Energy, a Washington-based consulting firm. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break to discuss sex work.
She's a handsome. I have been indulging in a sensuous display, doing a little more than eat three square meals a day. And I've been shirking my duty, so I'm sending gifts to Carrie Favor. But because I love you, and because you love me, a model worker, I'll willingly be.
That was some of Model Worker by Magazine. My next guest is Peter Fraes. Peter is an editor with the excellent new magazine Jacobin, a publication that's evidence that the youth of today have sharp political minds and fine writing talents. It's on the web at jacobinmag.com, and also in print by mail. Peter Fraes has a nice blog post there about the problem with defending sex work and sex workers, which is something I often do, sometimes to the distress of listeners who find the whole thing degrading and oppressive. I don't. Peter Fraes argues that the problem with that defense is that it's too favorable to work. I don't think I'm as anti-work as he is, but I must confess that the less work position does have its appeal. The term sex work always reminds me of what an old writer pal of mine said back in the late 80s on hearing the term culture workers. What? We got into culture so we didn't have to work. Okay, here's Peter Fraes. Welcome, Peter. Let's talk some about sex and work, or sex slash work, or however you want to divide it out. But first of all, there's a kind of thinking that sex work is somehow uniquely awful because of the sex part. Let's talk about that first before we talk about the work part. What's your reaction to that?
Well, on one level,
it's understandable in that it's part of people's general reluctance to see every part of life commodified, right? And so there's an instinctive feeling that, well, something as intimate as sex shouldn't be commodified, it shouldn't be on the market. But when you think about it, really it's hard to avoid the conclusion that this is a pretty arbitrary hang-up about sex, since we commodify intimacy in all kinds of other ways.
What is it about sex that makes people do that?
Well, there's multiple reasons. But one of them, I think, has to do with the idea, sort of an unexamined idea about the family more generally as sort of a haven from capitalism or from market relations, right? And that so that protecting sex has become sort of like a core part of protecting this sort of romanticized idea of, you know, this haven from commodification.
But now let's talk some about the work part then. So if sex is not so special a realm or should not be so special a realm, let's talk some about work and commodification. Are we just so inured to life under commodified work relations that we can't think about anything else?
Well, this is the troublesome thing. The thing that I tried to get at in the post that I wrote about this, which is that in the debates about sex work that you see both on the left and in a more mainstream circle, there's a really unproductive dichotomy that arises between, on the one side, the people who say this is just horrible, degrading, misogynistic, we need to stamp out sex work. And then on the other side, people who say, well, this is just a job and it should be a job like any other, in the sense that, oh, it can be fulfilling or it can be empowering. And the problem with that has less to do with the specifics of sex work than with the assumptions about work in general, that are, you know, we're supposed to get dignity and fulfillment and meaning out of our jobs, when all kinds of people have bad and degrading and demeaning jobs that are not sex-related, and that often the reason that people do sex work in the first place is not because they think it's so great, but because it's great relative to what the other options are.
Well, then what about work? I mean, you know, I think the standard reaction is, well, we may not like it, but we have no choice. What do you say to that?
Who do you mean?
Well, I think if you stop just about anyone in the street, you say, yeah, I don't like work, but, you know, what choice do I have? What would you say to that?
That, of course, is the root of the problem. There's, of course, greater and lesser degrees to which you don't have a choice about it, right? Even under capitalism, we've managed to decommodify labor to a certain extent. The existence of some kind of a social safety net, the existence of some kind of unemployment insurance, it lessens people's total subservience to, you know, whatever job is on offer, whatever's available to them in the market. And my contention is simply that we can go farther in that direction, and we shouldn't simply assume that more work is better or that work is valuable simply because it's work. It's one thing to say that there's socially necessary tasks that need to be done and we need to get people to do them some way. It's another thing to say that it's just better for people to be working because there's something inherently redeeming about work.
There's a line, I think it's in Conrad's Lord Jim, not Lord Jim, Heart of Darkness, in which Marlowe says something to the effect that what work allows you to do is find yourself, which sounds like a proto-60s idea, but I think that's what he said. What do you say to that aspect of work? I mean, people find it somehow, even if the boss steals some of their energy and some of the value they produce, that there is something that they find expressive or developmental about it.
I mean, I would say that's certainly possible, and for some people it's true, although, of course, it's a pretty privileged middle-class vision of what work is like. But then there's that idea sort of exists in tension with the notion that we need to keep everyone in fear of starvation or in fear of being on the streets in order to get them to work. If work was really so wonderful as all that, then maybe people would go and do it even if they didn't have to. If that's the case, well, then great. But that's no reason not to make it possible for people to find other ways of organizing their lives and other things that they may find fulfilling that are not wage labor.
Well, I think then your person on the street would say there's a lot of odious stuff that has to be done. How can you get anybody to do it without compulsion?
And that's sort of a good question. And in some ways, it's a it's a debate that would be sort of worth having. It's a political question. I mean, if somebody has to clean the toilets, who does it, and how is that organized? And we sort of hide that problem by having masses of low-wage laborers who have no other choice but to do it. I mean, if you instituted something like, you know, I'm a supporter of the idea of the universal basic income, paying everyone some baseline amount of money that allows people to survive at some reasonable level without working. Now, if you did that and you suddenly discovered that there was just a massive shortage of people doing certain kinds of dirty, ugly jobs, well, then there would have to be some debate about what do we do about that. Do we have some sort of, you know, national service requirement? Do we just massively raise the wages for that kind of work? There's all kinds of things that could happen. But it's a debate that would be better to have in the open rather than sort of hiding it.
Now, this basic income level you imagine, something a little better than subsistence, something more generous than that? I mean, what level of comfort do people get provided with if they're not going to toil?
I mean, that's obviously another thing that would be a matter of great political contention. To me, the thing that's politically important is that it is actually possible to survive without work. And what that means, of course, is a matter of debate. Does it just mean, at a minimum, you can feed and clothe yourself and you have a roof over your head? How does it relate to being able to raise children? How does it relate to where you can live? There's all sorts of things like that. But the general idea of something that allows you, if you want to, not live at an extremely high level, but at least live outside of work is the key. And this is one of the interesting things about it, about the basic income as an idea, is that it has this sort of nonlinear quality where if it's very low, if you give people an amount of money that's not really enough to live on, what you're doing is sort of subsidizing low-wage labor because people still have to work, but you can pay them even less, which is why there are right-wing advocates of the basic income, but who tend to prefer it at that sort of low subsistence level. But my view is that if something like that existed, just having it at any level would be something that would be possible to fight over and possible to ratchet up, and so it would be worth winning even if it began below subsistence level.
Then you have the political problem of people saying, well, why should I work if that bum is sitting on his butt and doing nothing and collecting a check?
Well, which is exactly right, which is partly why the basic income, in the way that the proposal is generally structured, is literally universal. Like, literally everyone gets it. And obviously, if you're making a lot of money otherwise, then it forms a less significant portion of your income, but it's literally not conditional on anything. So, in theory, anyone could say could be that bum on the dole. And obviously, that gets back to what we were talking about before. If it turns out that really nobody wants to do anything and everything is falling apart, well, then that's when you have to have the political struggle about that. But it has a very different dynamic than the kind of traditional welfare programs that we've had, which do sort of create this invidious distinction between the workers and the parasites, right? Which creates a very reactionary political dynamic.
Now, as I recall, in the classic days of Swedish social democracy, they were very generous in creating jobs for people if they couldn't find one, but you had to work if you were physically capable of it. It was very expensive to do this active labor market policy. I believe it was about 2.5% of GDP they spent on it, which is not all that far from what we spend on the military. But what would you say to something like that, that kind of a universal work requirement rather than just a universal income without work benefit?
Well, one has to question what the purpose of having such a requirement is. Again, if it's because there are certain social needs that need to be filled, then that's one thing. But if it's just because you think that it's better for people to be working than not, and that it's somehow, you know, good for the soul to be working rather than just collecting a paycheck, I find that to be unconvincing and sort of circular, right? That work becomes a source of meaning and dignity because we say it is, and we continue to reinforce that sense by creating make work even when we don't need to.
The Swedes are good Protestants. They're driven by that consideration.
Right, right, and that's sort of part of why the kind of politics that I'm pushing here is very self-consciously, you know, anti-ascetic, geared toward we don't have to justify our existence by talking about how self-sacrificing and hardworking we are. We live in incredibly rich societies that should be able to provide us with better and easier standard of living, you know?
Well, the society is rich in part because people are driven by that work ethic. And would, if you took away that the compulsion to work, wouldn't it rapidly become less rich?
Well, that's a question, and it sort of raises again this question about whether people, to what extent, are the things that make a society, particularly societies of the kind of economies of the kind we live in now, are the kinds of things that make them rich, that people are, what are people driven by? In other words, are they driven by the desperate need to make money, or is it in fact the case that a lot of people, if they were somewhat less dependent on the need to make money, might work hard, or however you want to put it, at things that are valuable to others, things that make society a better place? You know, I think we already see that lots of people, as much as they can, sacrifice income in order to do things that they find, that they sort of find personally fulfilling. I mean, obviously, I'm doing a PhD. I know lots of people who believe that, you know, teaching and learning, you know, and researching are valuable and fulfilling things to do, and that they're willing to do even if it means living at a, you know, a level of income far below what their peers might make. You know,
You're certainly not in it for the money, are you?
Right, exactly. And I think that's, again, this is another tension that exists, I think, in sort of bourgeois rhetoric about work, which is that on the one hand, it insists that people are really only motivated by money, and so that if they weren't in fear of being in poverty, then nobody would do any work. But at the same time, if you say, you know, to a lot of, you know, I think to your average upper middle class professional, right, do you just do your job for the money? I think a lot of people would be actually offended by that.
I think the exception is people on Wall Street. I don't think they'd do that work if it weren't for the money.
But then again, that's a perfect example of the kind of work we don't need, right?
You need a lot of money to get people to do that. No, there's a anecdote in Frank Partnoy's book Fiasco, where he asked all these colleagues in the Morgan Stanley's derivatives department, if it weren't for the money, would you rather do this or work in the Long Island Railroad? And all his colleagues said they'd rather work in the Long Island Railroad.
Right.
Now, what kind of reaction do you get when you talk to people about this idea of a basic income? Is it popular or met with skepticism or hostility?
I mean, I think the first reaction I generally get is, well, this, you know, that sounds great, but it's unrealistic, by which they mean either it's politically unrealistic or it's economically unrealistic, or both. Less common, but something that you also get, is people who are uneasy about the idea, like even if it could be implemented, because they're afraid of what would happen if people's dependence on wage labor was lifted like that. And so, for instance, some people are worried that, you know, we're all going to dissipate ourselves in consumerism, and it's going to be like that movie WALL-E, where we're all fat and being, you know, carted around and wasting ourselves. That's sort of the more interesting reaction to me, because it shows that there is still, even on the left, this feeling that we need the sort of self-discipline and self-denial of work in order to prevent us from completely destroying ourselves.
Well, it also seems that a lot of people on the left have been very shy about challenging the whole logic of capitalist work discipline. They just, you know, they think they can do conventional economics in some ways better than the bourgeois can, but they really don't want to be seen as encouraging sloth.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's the debate that that you get between the mainstream right and left is that the liberals say that everybody, the working class, is virtuous and hardworking and self-sacrificing. The only problem is that our policymakers have failed to create enough jobs. And then on the right, you get the people who say, you know, the Chicago School economists who say that the recession is just caused by people not wanting to work, or Charles Murray saying that it's the white working class has lost its industriousness or whatever. But you don't get anyone questioning the idea that what we should want is this sort of disciplined, hardworking, Protestant kind of working class, you know.
Well, then a lot of people, certainly to the left of the Democratic Party, would say that the Obama stimulus package was not ambitious enough, that it did not create enough jobs. It was not explicitly a jobs package. How do you feel about the idea of supporting some kind of large-scale jobs package of that sort?
Well, again, to some degree, creating jobs can be valuable. It can be valuable, actually, in its own right. There obviously are things that need doing that aren't getting done. There's, you know, crumbling infrastructure and things like that. But what frustrates me in the debate about jobs is the way which we conflate the need for jobs and the need for full employment. Since full employment doesn't just mean lots of jobs, even though people talk about it that way. It means it's the technical condition. It means that the number of people looking for work meets the number of jobs that are available, but there are all kinds of ways to get there. And there's, you know, reducing the length of the work week and making it easier to survive outside of the labor force are also part of getting to full employment, and that part of the package never gets talked about.
What do you think of the prospects are for this sort of agenda in an era of what looks to be chronically high unemployment?
I mean, in the short run, I think it's the prospects are not great. It's certainly, I recognize that it seems like a strange time to be mounting a lot of these critiques because we're so far from full employment, because the proximate problem seems to be not enough work rather than too much work. But I think it's for that reason that sort of for the long haul, it's important to mount this ideological critique to try and move the terms of the debate at least a little bit so that we don't find ourselves stuck in the same, going through the same rigmarole over and over again.
And I imagine some of the stiffest opposition, of course, would come from the upper classes. The bourgeoisie would hate such a thing because it might make life a little too easy.
Yeah. And of course, there's also the cultural problem that our contemporary ruling class relative to other ruling classes in history, many of them work quite hard. Granted, they may work hard at socially destructive things like trading derivatives on Wall Street. But nevertheless, there is the work ethic is strong among much of the bourgeoisie, and so this makes it all the easier for them to sort of project this need to impose work discipline onto the whole rest of society.
Many years ago, Barbara Ehrenreich ended an essay with the call, "Workers of the World, Relax." Would you join in that call?
Yeah, absolutely. I'd go back to Paul Lafargue back in the 1880s, who wrote "The Right to Be Lazy." That's what I'm after here.
All right, thanks a lot, Peter.
That was Peter Frey, an editor with the fine new publication, Jacobin. You can find out more about the magazine at Jacobin Mag. That's jacobinmag.com. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, some of Never Work by the Mekons. Till next week, bye.